Welcome, everybody, to Health, Wealth, and Divine. My name is Juwanza. Thank you so much for tuning in. It's a beautiful day. I hope it's beautiful wherever you are. It's definitely beautiful down here where I am, and I hope everybody's enjoying their day, and I'm going to add to that joy today with an awesome, awesome show on entrepreneurship. For all of you entrepreneurs out there, you know that it's not an easy thing being an entrepreneur. You know, there's a lot that you have to know. Starting a business, growing a business, bank statements, financial statements, cash flow forecasts, business plans. There's a lot that goes into owning and starting and operating your own business. And it's with that in mind that my special guest actually has written an awesome, awesome book called Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top, 105 Business Principles. It's in its fourth edition now. And again, for all of you who have been following the show regularly, thank you so much for tuning in. To all of the new listeners, I would just like to say welcome. You're in for a treat today. Again, entrepreneurship is a very, very serious, serious matter. And if not done properly, if you don't lay the proper foundation, the odds are not in your favor that you're going to be successful. And so, again, that is why this book was written. My special guest today is, of course, Professor Joseph T. Geiger. Again, the book is called Entrepreneurial Success, 105 Business Principles, The Road to the Top. And we're going through the book principle by principle, chapter by chapter. And we're very, very fortunate to have Professor Geiger as my guest today because he's done it. When you're talking to somebody and you're sitting and listening to them share their knowledge, you want to know that, okay, well, where did this knowledge come from? What is this knowledge born out of? Well, in this particular case, it's born out of experience. He's got over 50 years experience as an entrepreneur. And for those of you who might not be familiar with him, I'll share a little bit with you on him. He's currently retired, but Professor grew up on a Kansas farm and graduated from the School of Business at the University of Denver. And over his lifetime, he has started over 10 businesses, two of which predated his college graduation. And after his second retirement, he taught entrepreneurship and small business management. And in order to help people like yourself and myself succeed in business, he wrote this book, Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top, 101 Practical Business Principles. And the book just keeps growing. And he now lectures and teaches seminars. And again, we're very, very fortunate to have someone of his caliber share with us today. So without further ado, I want to get to my special guest, Professor. Welcome back to Health, Wealth, and Divine. It's a pleasure to have you back. We'll have to pick up our conversation that we were having prior to the show a little bit later. But again, I want to thank you so much for being my guest today. It's always a pleasure, and we're very fortunate to have someone with your qualifications on the show today.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, as I was mentioning to the listeners, that, you know, entrepreneurship is a very serious, serious thing. A lot of energy goes to that, a lot of time, a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, in some cases a lot of money, and it's not something to be done willy-nilly. You know, if you want to be successful, you got to do it the right way. There are ways to do it, there are ways not to do it, and, you know, you have written an awesome book here really outlining the ways to success, basically, the road to the top. And I want to encourage everybody, if you're serious about being an entrepreneur, you need to get this book. There are a lot of books out there on entrepreneurship, but this book is different. This book it shows you how to do what it is that you need to do. And there are principles involved, not just principles for business, but principles for life as well. Professor, what made you write the book? Because it is a different book. You get into the how-to. Was there something that sparked that approach to you writing this book?
Yeah, it really was. When I first started to teach, I enjoyed it. I think the students enjoyed it. And I had a number of students come to me and say, gee, I wish I had talked to you before I started started my own business because I lost my shirt. And I had, in many cases, they had taken college courses. They had read other books, and they told them what they needed to do, but they didn't tell them how to do it. And once you get your own business, remember that it's your money that's being put at risk here. So knowing how to do something is what's important. Knowing what to do is great, but if you don't know how to do it, it doesn't help you at all. As a matter of fact, it can hurt you. It can get you in trouble because you think you know how to do something, and you really don't. You just know what should be done. And many of the college courses and the books tell you what should be done, but they do not tell you how to do it. And the 105 business principles, virtually all of them have a story with them. And the story tells how it was done in a particular case. Many of them, my own experience. Others, some experience that others had that I observed or they told me about. But always the only part that I was really interested in is how to do it. In the first book that I wrote with 101 principles, one of the things I left out was how you go about hiring people. Everybody knows that you ought to hire good people. Well, I say that, everybody knows, but quite frankly, some don't seem to know that. But I didn't know how to do it. And it was one of the things that plagued me throughout my entire business career, that I didn't have a system down that I could execute. And I read about things, and they gave me all this high-flying stuff, but I never could figure out how to execute it. And a friend of mine had a system that was easy to execute. And once he told me about it, I said, wow, I wish I'd have known that. So I included that in the later editions of how you do something. In this case, how do you go about hiring good people? How do you, when somebody walks in and says, I want a job, and you have openings, how do you decide that this person is a good person with some kind of a system that is reliable, that is executable? And I never had that, and I wished I had, because, boy, that would have helped me a lot. I hired lots and lots of people, and quite frankly, many of them were not well suited for the job. Had I known this principle of how to do it, a guy by the name of Jerry Quirk was the one who told me how. And had I had his principles, it would have been much, much easier, and I'd have been far more successful. Because people, good people, are the bedrock of a successful business.
You know, Professor, that is, you know, learning through trial and error. And that's the thing, that this book will help people who are going into business not to have to go through, because you did mention that there were some things that you learned just by observing other people's experiences. And, of course, in addition to your own experiences, if you can learn from somebody else's mistakes, then that's certainly can save you a lot of energy and time and money. Unfortunately, a lot of times people say, oh, well, you know, as in business and in life, oh, that's them, that's not me. But some things are principles that just apply across the board, you know. So, again, I want to thank you so much for, you know, writing the book, because so many entrepreneurs are going to benefit from it. And I wish I knew the number of how many have already benefited from the book. And I'm, you know, attesting to the, because I've read it several times, and I know that the information in it is solid and sound. So, again, I want to encourage everybody. We're going to tell you how you can get the book during the course of the show, because it's a must if you're serious about becoming an entrepreneur, or even if you are already an entrepreneur, it's a must, because there's some things that you might know, but there you can always learn something. You know, if you approach something thinking that you know it all, you're bound to miss something, because nobody knows it all. So this book can feed you in becoming successful and remaining successful. We talked about, Professor, earlier, you talked about how to, that this book is a how-to book. And the principle that we'll be discussing, principle number 65, is add value to your product or service. Add value to your product or service. So let's talk about that. How does someone do that? How do I do that?
Well, in this case, I think it is it's something that all of us can do by looking at what other businesses have done. What are some of the businesses who have been extremely successful in adding value to their products? And the reason you want to add value is to get a larger market share. So the people say, well, to get a larger market share, you need to sell more, so let's cut the price. Well, that's great, but when you cut the price, you also cut your profits, and very often you cut your profits and turn them into losses, which probably is not what you want to do. And but what companies, what types of businesses are constantly adding value that all of us can personally observe? And I think one is the automobile business. When I first bought my first car, it had a 3-speed transmission, and it was a shift. It had 3 forwards and 1 reverse, and you shifted it. And the windows you rolled up with cranks, there was no such thing as air conditioning. That wasn't invented yet for cars, and on and on. Well, all of those things and many, many more have been invented. So a number of years ago, I bought a little pickup truck. And being a farm guy, it was pretty much a working pickup truck. The only thing that I had that was not the sort of thing we would have had in a Kansas farm, it was air-conditioned, and the pickups on the Kansas farm weren't. Of course, at that time, they weren't invented. The air conditioning for cars was not invented. And quite frankly, if it is, my dad probably would have said, you boys do not need air conditioning. I'm not paying for it. So, and the same thing with automatic shift. Well, all those things have happened. That truck at the time was about a $18,000-$19,000 truck as a basic truck. And the list price that I paid for it was around $24,000. However, I could have easily, with the exact same truck, it was a Dodge 1500 Ram, that exact same truck, I could have paid $45,000 with just extras, bigger engines, fancier interior, all kinds of stuff. Four-door instead of two-door and four-wheel drive, on and on and on. And the truck manufacturers, Dodge, Chevy, Ford, and all of the others, they tell me that when I've asked them about it, that a basic truck with manual shift, no air conditioning, all of that, they barely break even on. Maybe they make 2 or 3%, not much. However, the optional extras is where they really clean up. You add air conditioning to it, and let's say it's $1,000. The cost to the manufacturer delivered to the dealership is probably $500. But they make a lot of money on that. Air conditioning. They make a lot of money on automatic transmission. They make a lot of money on four doors and four-wheel drives. All of those things, the interiors, they make a killing on. If they charge $300 for something, I doubt if it costs them $100 to deliver it to the dealer. They just make a real killing on that. And that, because of that, the basic pickup truck, which maybe they made 2 or 3%, by the time the average sale goes out, they're making 25 to 30%, and it's all in the optional extras. Why do they do that? It's because people want them and are willing to pay these, I would think, exorbitant prices, but obviously the buying public doesn't think they're exorbitant. They think they're just fine. I'm sure they'd like to pay less, but they're perfectly willing to pay what the manufacturer charges. That's how you take a basic product and you add value to it, because you figure out what people want and you add that to the basic product. And another one is our computers. The computers now, if you've got a basic computer, you can buy one of those, a laptop, for a couple $100. But you can also buy a laptop for a couple $1,000. Why would you pay all that much more? Because it has bells and whistles that you want. That's why. And the manufacturers understand that, so they design the basic product, and then they add stuff to it. Now, in the car business, Mercedes, Cadillac, the luxury cars, very often they have very few options. A number of years ago, when I was in the airplane business, I had a Lincoln Continental. And the Lincoln Continental had one option. Their option sheet had one item in it, and it was a very, very fancy video or radio with a 10-disc or 20-disc automatic player. And that was the only option that they had. All the other stuff was standard. And that's how they did it. That's how they justified the higher price. Now, if you took a Ford Fairlane and you added all the options, you could pretty well get it up to the price of a Continental. But and it basically was the same car. It's the same engine. It was a lot of stuff was the exact same stuff. But the luxuries put all of that as standard, and that's another way of adding value to your product.
So if the customer or consumer is willing to pay whatever the price is that you have it listed for, then, of course, like you mentioned, they would love to pay less. But let's say, for example, just to use round numbers, let's say, for example, you bought something for $1,000 and you sold it for $3. Now, the customer doesn't know you bought it for $1,000, and even though they would buy it for $3, in many cases, if they knew you bought it for $1,000, they would have a problem paying $3 for it. You know what I'm saying? So, but when it comes
in jewelry. For years and years and years, since I was a little boy, I don't know what it is now because I'm kind of past that, but I don't buy that sort of thing anymore. But back when I did, I knew what jewelry stores were doing. And when you went in and bought a diamond for your dearly beloved, soon to be your wife, and you paid $2,000 for, you can pretty well figure that the jewelry store bought it for $700, and they sold it for you to $2,000, three times what they paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
That was standard. That was everywhere. Now, a few jewelry stores don't do that now. They say they don't do it. I don't really know what they do because before when I was in the market for that sort of thing, I found out what they did, and if you do a deep dive, you're able to do that. But very often, the perceived value of something will go down if you lower the price, and the perceived value goes up when you raise the price. You'd have a very, very hard time convincing me that Lincoln Continental that I bought was worth twice in transportation what a Ford of the same vintage was selling for. I mean, it got me from point A to point B. It was very comfortable, but so was the Ford. And quite frankly, today, if you bought a Kia, you probably have better transportation than you would have had in a Mercedes buying it 30 years ago. They're just better vehicles. They last longer. They cost less to operate, and they're better. They have improved them. But lowering the price very often lowers the perceived value. And there have been all kinds of tests that prove that when I was in college, there was one on toothpaste. And I forgot, one of the major toothpaste companies decided that they would run a test. And let's say at that time, a tube of toothpaste cost $2. So they offered it for $1. The only difference between the $1 tube of toothpaste and the $2 tube of toothpaste was the printing on the tube. Other than that, it was exactly the same. Came off the same friggin' production line. Guess what?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody would buy the $1 toothpaste. So perceived value, dropping the price, very often, one thing it will do for sure, it will hurt your profits. But another thing it may very well do is it may very well drop the perceived value of the product. And we buy things based on perceived value. If you're in a market for a Lincoln Continental, and the Lincoln Continental is $60,000, you're not in the market for a $30,000 Kia.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the difference in the transportation from getting you from point A to point B? Well, the truth is nothing. But you want a perceived value in that Lincoln Continental as you perceive it. So be real careful about dropping prices.
You know, and the perceived value could just come in the form of the name, because you could take a Mercedes Benz and a Mazda or a Volvo or whatever, and if they took the Volvo name and put it on the Mercedes, and took the Mercedes name and stuck it on the Volvo, in many cases, if you weren't able to just look at the car, you know, based on its shape and model and know the difference, and they put you in the car, you might not be able to even tell the difference in the ride.
Well, if you really want to see how that works, look at the ladies' clothes and go to Neiman Marcus and price a particular brand and style of clothing there or shoes, and then go to a much less well-known store, maybe even Walmart, and you can find the exact same pillow or underwear or shoe or dress, exactly the same, same manufacturer, same everything, and it's half the price. And people who buy at Neiman Marcus wouldn't be caught dead buying that exact same product for half the price at Walmart. And people who go to Walmart think that anybody going to Neiman Marcus and paying twice as much for the exact same thing ought to have their head examined. But both survive. And so, you know, and this is a case that they're identical products. I mean, made by the same people. But it costs half as much or twice as much. And there's all kinds of examples of that.
Yeah, go ahead, Professor. Even if you take ties, men's ties, for an example, you know, somebody might not be caught dead in a tie that cost. I mean, you have ties that people sell on the street sometimes, you know what I mean? Just racks and racks of ties. A person wouldn't be caught dead buying a tie off the street, but they might spend God knows how much for an expensive tie in an expensive men's clothing store and never get a compliment on it. You know, they paid all this money for a tie, and nobody walked up to them and said, "Man, you know, I like that tie. Where'd you get it?" You know?
Yeah.
So, perceived value, back to perceived value.
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah, I actually did that. I was in Florida, and I needed a shirt. and I went into a store that was, which was, I don't know whether it was Neiman Marcus, but it was a similar store. And the men's shirts they had there were up to $200. And I thought, you got to be kidding me. I mean, nobody in the world would spend $200 for a white shirt. And, oh, yes, they would. And so I went two blocks away to a Penny's, and I think I bought a perfectly usable shirt for like $15. And I couldn't tell the difference. I mean, maybe somebody else could, but I couldn't.
Yeah, I don't think walking around, look at Professor Joseph Geiger in that cheap $15 shirt. I don't think anybody was saying that.
No, I don't think
they
so.
They couldn't tell.
So the value of your product or service in adding value to it, there's a whole lot of ways to do it, and the fundamental way is to figure out what people want and then give it to them. So if they want air conditioning in their car, you give it to them as an option. And that way you can advertise your car at $15,000 or $18,000, but you know full well that the average one that goes off the lot is going to be almost twice that. And that's where your profits are, in the almost twice, where all that extra stuff. So that's what you do as a business person.
Interesting. Everybody, I hope you're enjoying this information because it's very, very valuable. We're going to move on to principle number 65. 65, yes. Don't compete against yourself. Now, that seems that's very good advice. But when you say don't compete against yourself, Professor, what do you mean?
Well, very often people will offer multiple options or similar things. The one I can think of, I like to hunt and fish, and if you want to buy a little aluminum boat, you can buy them from a manufacturer starting at about 14 feet and going to 24 foot in 1 foot increments. And what you do is you confuse the buyer. Why should the buyer buy a 16-foot boat instead of a 17 or a 15? And all you're doing is confusing the buyer terribly. So you shouldn't do that. What you should do is figure out what people want and then give it to them so that they can make a logical choice. If you go to today, I was using a hand drill to put together some wood, you know, run some big screws into stuff. And if I had gone to the Home Depot and other manufacturers or other retailers, there are five or six or seven different makes and models of electric drills. If you go to a good marketer, you'll find maybe they'll have two, possibly three brands, seldom more than that, because they don't want to confuse the customer. So they might have a drill, a skill that sells for $30, and then they may have a middle one that sells for $80, and they may have a DeWalt commercial that sells for $150. All of them are drills. They all do exactly the same thing. But one is made to use at home, and if you drop it off a two-story building, it's going to die. If you drop the DeWalt off of a four-story building, it's going to bounce. And you go down and pick it up, and it works fine. But that's what you're paying all that money for. But you don't want to compete against yourself. You don't want to have so many choices that people won't make a choice. And that's very often what happens.
Well, do you think that the people that are competing against themselves in that way are viewing it as though, well, maybe the difference in choices could be difference in price, and so as well, so they might feel like, well, if somebody cannot afford, say, the DeWalt, maybe we can give them, you know, something that's less expensive. Give them, you know, that way we can get all of the dollars. We can get the dollars from those, you know, for the expensive drills on down to the least expensive.
Well, I think that's true, but I think that's doing it the wrong way. The right way to do it is to figure out what your customer wants. If you have a lady or a young person coming into your store and they say, I want to buy a drill, and your first question should not be to take them to the $180 drill, but how are you going to use it? And if the prospect says, well, I'm a contractor and I'm a roofer and I need a new drill, you take them to the DeWalt. If they say, well, we just moved and we need to hang some pictures, maybe you ought to take them to the Skill at $25. And then if they see the more expensive one, say, well, this is a commercial. And there, it's the same difference between a Caterpillar tractor that's made to run for years and years and years and be abused, and a little home unit that's designed to be put in a shed, and when it rains, you go in and you wipe the water off of it. So that's the difference. Now, if you want the DeWalt to put the pictures up, that's fine, you know. But I would never push that. I would do it the other way. I would go to say, how are you going to use it? Well, I want to mount some pictures in my new home. Fine. This little guy will work fine. It will work for years. You'll be happy with it. But do not think that if you get a job as a contractor and you're going to be using it and recharging it 8 hours a day, that it's going to hold up under those kind of conditions, because it frankly won't. But if you use it once every 3 weeks, it'll hold up for the next 30 years.
Well, my next question relating to that is one that we talked about once in a prior show, but I think just for the new listeners, it would be beneficial if you would share on it. What about when you have somebody that's working off of commission and, you know, they don't get a regular hourly salary? Their bread and butter is what they sell. And, I mean, if they don't sell anything, they don't get paid, you know. So somebody coming in, let's say a car dealership, okay, and you know, they say they catch the woman by herself, right? You know, I had a buddy who worked at a car dealership once. He said they just love to see women coming in there by themselves. Women tend to be emotional shoppers. So what about somebody is buying a car or selling a car, shall I say, and they see somebody come in, they're working on commission, and the person, let's say, has a pre-qualification now, you know what I mean, from the bank. They're good to go. They can get this $30,000 car, $40,000 car, but they don't necessarily want to spend all of their money on it. I mean, they'd be perfectly satisfied with something maybe 1 or 2 years old. It doesn't have to be the current model. In the case of the salesperson, what would be your advice to the salesperson? Now, the person could very well say, okay, look, give me this $40,000 car, no problem, whatever. But the salesperson is basically going off a commission, so his approach to this sale might not be, let me make sure that the customer gets a car that might not ask them, so what are you using this car for? Are you just using this to run around in, or, you know, what's the purpose of the car? His approach might be different.
Well, that might be different, but I think what I would tell a salesman, and I was a salesman for yachts for 5 years. I was a salesman and ran a aircraft business selling airplanes for 20 years. And I gave myself the advice when I first started, and I think it was good advice that I gave it to others later. You get a commission when you sell something. So if you try to pump the person into the most expensive thing there is, and they walk out, even if they buy it, and then later on they realize that you really laid it to them, just remember, they're going to tell all their friends that. And if you tell them that what you did is you tried to find the best match for them, they'll tell their friends that too. And you sell cars or airplanes or yachts with repeat customers. I worked with a guy selling yachts who had been at it for many, many years. He'd been the head of the shop for a long time. He knew everybody. This was in out of Houston, Texas. And if a guy walked in the store, Ted Dozier very often knew him and knew him personally. And the reason he was there is because he was repeat customer, because Ted always tried to give his customer the very best he could for what they wanted to spend. And they were sending him people all the time. I can't tell you the number of times that some guy would drive up in a new Mercedes, and it would be my up, so I would go trotting out there, and he'd stick his hand out, and he'd say, "Hi, is Ted Dozier here?" And I thought, oh, shucks. There goes a dead sale. It's easy. It's a rollover, because either they knew him or they were sent to him. And I never got those guys, but Ted did, and he made four times what I did. Now, I made a very good living, but in today's world, Ted was making $750,000. So he was doing extremely well, and that's how he did it.
Yeah, and you said something very, very important earlier, too. The person could very well walk away. They don't necessarily have to buy.
Oh, yeah, they don't have to buy.
They might not get anything.
Right. Right.
Professor,
so better to get a small commission from a small one, and the person will come back because they thought that you treated them right. You didn't try to sell them over their head or way more than they really wanted, and they will come back and they'll send their friends back.
Everybody, my special guest is Professor Joseph T. Geiger. We're going through the book, Entrepreneurial Success, 105 Business Principles, chapter by chapter, principle by principle. We're moving up to the 67th principle, which is entrepreneurs see opportunities, managers see problems. Professor?
Well, I think that's true. I think that's certainly it's true of me. I see opportunities all the time. I seldom go a week without blundering into an opportunity. But I don't see the problems. And that's why managers do not make good entrepreneurs. And entrepreneurs do not usually make good managers. So if you're an entrepreneur, you're good at finding ways to start a business, things to do, opportunities. You're good at that. You're good at putting it together and putting the organization together and getting things to run. But once it's up and running, and things are just kind of rolling along, you're probably not very good at that part. And the purpose of this little statement, entrepreneurs see opportunities, managers see problems, is I wrote that for people like me, that once the business is up and running, you might be well advised to get a COO, a chief operating officer, who's good at seeing problems. And my brother is a great example. He worked as a chemical engineer for Exxon, building chemical plants. And what he was really, really good at is seeing problems in the drawings when they actually got to building the darn plant. And Ollie said that he could see the problems they'd have and solve them before they happened. I wouldn't have been able to do that. I would just been, you know, just charging ahead. But mm-hmm. I wouldn't have seen the problems. He saw the problems, and he got his jobs generally ahead of schedule and under budget. Where somebody like me trying to do it, I would have been ended up behind schedule and way over budget because I wouldn't have seen the problems. But that's when you're running a business, if you're the owner, you better either be able to see the problems or understand that that's not your forte, and to find somebody who can, put them in charge, and then get the heck out of their way.
You know, Professor, you also got to be able to let that person that you hired know, if you hired them to be the manager, that you expect them to come to you and that you respect their opinion, because I can imagine that there are some people that they might see a problem and they don't really look forward to having to tell the boss, hey, we got a problem, you know, because of the way that the boss might react, you know. So, and the boss has to be open, you know, the owner has to open to say, hey, listen, you know, and thank them, you know, thank you for telling me because I wouldn't have known otherwise. How important is it for the owner to be open to hearing bad news if necessary?
Well, I got to tell you, it's one of the most difficult things you'll do if you own a business is to admit to yourself that you're not good at some function and to hire somebody who is good at it and then to get out of their way and not be sticking your thumb on everything, trying to put your own thumbprint on it. You make people who are good at that sort of thing angry with you, and pretty soon they'll just stop doing it, and you're in deep trouble. So my recommendation is when you get to that point where you need a chief operating officer, find somebody who's good at it, set them to work, and then get out of their way. Do not try to continue to run it. Make sure that there's an open communication between you and them so that they can go back and forth and tell them, like they said in The Godfather wants to hear bad news. And that's what you want to hear. You want to hear the bad news. You don't want to hear the good news. So the good news is great. That's fine. But what you want to hear is the bad news before it happens so you can do something about it. And that is very difficult for, I can tell you from personal experience, that was one of the big challenges I had to finally figure out that I was really not good at something and put somebody to work at it and then get out of their way and go do the things I was good at.
Well, I guess that's where trust comes in. And if you could talk about that for a moment, because it's like if you can imagine a couple who, you know, just had a baby, and then at some point they feel like, okay, we need to get a babysitter. And can you imagine the first time they had to leave the baby with the babysitter, you know, and they weren't there, you know? That takes a lot of trust. I mean, because because that's your baby, and it's the same, I guess, with the business, that's your baby. I mean, you've birthed it, you've nurtured it, you've watched it grow, and now to hire a manager and say, okay, I'm going to trust you, you know, with my baby. I'm going to pay you to watch my baby to make sure that it runs, you know, that it's healthy and so forth. That takes a lot of trust.
It certainly does, and it's very difficult to do. I got to tell you, that was one of the most difficult things I finally figured out that I could not do it all, and I had to have help, and I had to get the help to do the best job they could. And it was very difficult. I finally had what turned me around is I was out sticking my thumb on everything. And finally, one of the people who I really admired did a very good job, said, look, Geiger, you either stay out of this or find somebody else, but I'm not going to continue this deal with you in the middle of it. Either you do it or I do it, but we both can't do it. And so I'm out of here. You think about it over the weekend. I'll come in Monday morning, and if you want to, you know, there won't be any hard feelings. I'll be on my way. And, boy, it sobered me up in a hurry. And I figured out I was the one at fault, not him. And it worked out really well.
That takes humility, too, in the mirror to be able to admit that.
Yeah, I think it does. And it's, but you know, we were just, things weren't working very well. And because of that, and, you know, after that, I would tell people that, look, I'm a strong personality, and so are you. If I'm getting in your way, for God's sakes, come at me and come at me hard and tell me either, you know, I'm going to do this or you're going to do it, but we both can't do it. You have to have one person who is the manager. Now, I'm the owner, and you need to come to me to if you're going to make big changes. But so long as they're not big changes, go for it. And it took me a long time to figure that out. Finally did, and things worked better.
You know, before we move on to the next principle, I just want to jump in here with this, because even when it comes to designating authority and giving your managers or people under you a certain amount of authority, for example, hiring and firing. For example, let's say, for example, you had an employee, you're the owner, and that you like the employee. You thought the employee was a good employee, and then one day you come in and you're like, hey, I haven't seen Bill for a while, and the manager says, oh, I fired him. You know? You're like, you fired him? He's like, yeah, I had to fire him, you know, because, and tells you why he fired him. But even with that, that type of having that type of authority, you have to trust the other person's judgment. And, I mean, would you suppose that or advise in a situation like that, being the owner, that even though you might have delegated that hiring and firing authority to the manager, that they should run that past you?
No.
Before they make a decision?
No. If you, I mean, maybe they should mention it to you, but it should not be a requirement. Good managers will mention that sort of thing to you because they'll know, but they do not expect you to overrule them. And if you start overruling them, you got a problem on your hands, because pretty soon they're going to go. In the case of hiring and firing people, I learned, not early on, but I learned kind of in mid-entrepreneur life, as you would, that's one thing I was not good at, and I was never very comfortable with it. And so when somebody else took that over, I would, you know, they'd get me to okay things to start with, but I'd try to back off of that and say, look, pal, you're running it. If it runs fine, you're a hero. If it doesn't, you're going to get replaced. And but I'm not going to replace you because I didn't like the way you did things. I'm only going to replace you because what you did didn't work out. And the only way to do that is to let you do it. So, and I think that's this business of the manager having his thumb on something, or not the manager, but the owner, the entrepreneur, having his thumb on things. That's all well and good for those things that owner is good at, but there's going to be a bunch of them, and probably the day-to-day management are some of the things that the owner is not very good at. I certainly wasn't, and I finally got around to admitting that.
Well, Professor, do we have time for, we've got about 10 minutes left in the show, do we have time for one more, which was you can grow your business into bankruptcy, or do you want to hold?
Sure. No, we can do that. So basically, you can grow your business into bankruptcy. What happens is a business grows. Let's say that you're running a men's ready-to-wear store, and it's doing really well. And you think, well, what can I do to increase our business? And the answer is, out of this store at this location, I may be able to make some changes on the margins, but I really can't I can't do anything pretty major. Now, what I can do that's major is go to a city or a town that's 20 miles away or 500 miles away and open another store. I opened this first one, or in some case, I bought the first one, and I know how to run it. It's running pretty good. We know where to buy the merchandise. We know how much to have and so on. And so, hey, this should be easy. I survived starting this thing up and got through all of those hurdles. Now that I know how to do that, it should be really easy to start the new store. And what happens to you when you do that is you got to staff the new store. So how do you do that? Well, you go through the people you now have, and you pick the best ones who you know are really, really good. So you put them in charge of your new store. You understand that it's going to take a little while for it to grow, and that's okay because you have the income from the current store. But what you don't have is the people who made the current store run. You may think you made it run, but the truth is you kind of made it run. Who really made it run are the people on the ground who were talking to your customers and dealing with them day to day. And now the lead people are gone. They're at the new one. So what happens to you, and I saw this happen over and over again, is the existing store, the number one store, began to fade. And when it began to fade, then the income stream began to fade, and that's what you were depending on to get the new store running. Well, you no longer have that. And the new store is getting going, but the people, they don't know the new location. They don't know the new customers, so everything takes longer and costs more, and your income stream is going downhill. So, and you run yourself into bankruptcy. You grow yourself into bankruptcy. The purpose of growth is to make a profit. If you cannot make a profit pretty quickly at the growth for a small business, don't do it. You're going to be in deep trouble. So that's meant by growing yourself into bankruptcy, and I've seen it happen over and over again. And it damn near happened to me.
See, you're hearing the voice of wisdom, everybody. So you're talking specifically about small business, right? Because I could hear somebody saying, "Well, what about Starbucks? I mean, they've got stores all over the place, or you know."
But those are franchises now. See, that's a different deal. Franchise is a whole different kettle of fish. You got two kinds of business: the operating business, which the franchisor, you or me, have a Starbucks store. But Starbucks is the one who's supplying the coffee and the cups and the this and the that and the recipes and so on, the basic layout of the store, but they aren't running it. So that's a whole different kettle of fish. A better example would be Kroger's. Kroger's, when they open a store, a grocery store, primarily it's run by Kroger's. It's not a franchise. But a franchise is a very easy business to run. That's why there's so many of them around. You come up with a system that seems to work, and you boil the system down in the as easy as you possibly can to make it work, and then you find people who will pay you to allow you to give them your system to work, and they pay you to do that. But you don't make it work. They do.
So these principles in the book, Professor, they can work for any business. I mean, any small business, from a flower shop to an automotive, you know, auto mechanic opening his own business to, you know, even some franchises, right? Somebody wants, I want to purchase a franchise. I mean, they still got to hire good people. They still got to, you know, keep the book. Still got to do a lot of the principles that are in this book. So this book is for just about any business that you could possibly think of. It's not just limited to, you know, selling airplanes or yachts, right?
That's correct. Yeah, the business, many of the principles, there's a whole bunch of them that I didn't come up with. People long, long before me came up with them. And you'll see in the book as you read through that a principal will say perhaps that this particular thing, who should I do? Oh, okay. There was a Chinese general, that Sun Tzu is his name, and Sun Tzu lived 2,500 years ago. And he wrote a book called The Art of War, which is still in print. If you go to a military academy in China or the United States or Great Britain or wherever you will, you're going to read Sun Tzu's Art of War. I mean, it's that pervasive. And in Sun Tzu's Art of War, there's a number of principles that Sun Tzu mentioned, and I use them myself. I give him credit, of course, that Sun Tzu said that the best experience is the best teacher. That's not me. That's Sun Tzu. And there are many others in there that there's probably 15 of the 105 principles that come directly from Sun Tzu, quoted word for word. And they have not changed in 2,500 years. And they're not going to change in the next 2,000 years. There are just many things in business that are truly fundamental, but you have to learn how to actually work them. And if you don't know how to work them, the experience is the best teacher. That's great information. But how do I do that? And that's what my book teaches you, how you actually do it.
Well, Professor, let's tell everybody how they can get this great book. I mean, because, again, I say to people, if you're serious about being an entrepreneur, then you need a guide. You know, you need a compass. These waters can get, you know, the terrain can get a bit rough sometimes, and the waters
can
get a little raging. So you need somebody to help you to navigate the waters and to, you know, tell you where the mines are. So how can they get this book, Professor?
Well, you can get it two ways. You can get it at Amazon. And when you go to Amazon, type in Entrepreneurial Success, 105 Business Principles. If you don't put the last part in there, the 105 Business Principles, you will eventually find it, but there's lots and lots of entrepreneurial success books. So that is one way. The other way is through my website, which is theroadtothetop.com, theroadtothetop.com, and I'll send it to you. In both cases, they're a little less than $19. And they both cost the same. Mine are signed. You're the ones out of Amazon or not. But nevertheless, you can get it both places.
Everybody, again, you need this book if you're serious. And I have to preface that by saying, you know, if you're serious, you need this book. Because, again, there's a lot to being an entrepreneur. There are a lot of things that you can think of, that you plan for, but there's a lot of stuff that happens that you just don't plan for. So what happens when you run into a situation that you just weren't prepared for because you just didn't see it coming? I mean, you can see up the street, but you can't see around the corner. So when something comes around the corner and you're not prepared for it, what do you do? You know, you don't want to wait until you're in the situation to know what to do. You want to at least have a reference point so that when something does come upon you that is unexpected, you can say, "Oh, I read about that in the book. Let me go back and get that book and see, and hone up on the principles and get a deeper understanding of what to do in this situation," because stuff happens and you want to be prepared. And we want to make sure that when you launch that business and you step out there, that you are fully equipped, fully prepared to handle all of the issues that could arise, so that you are not a statistic, a negative statistic, because many small businesses fail within the first year. You want to be in that number. You want to be in the number of those that succeed, and this book will definitely, definitely help you with that. Make sure that you tune in next time, everybody. We're going to be picking up on principle number 70, which is, I'm sorry, principle number 69 is, plan for the party before it starts. Plan for the party before it starts. Professor, great show. Awesome, awesome information, as I expected. Any parting words for our listeners today?
No, just come back and come back next week or 2 weeks from now when we have this. And Juanza and I are planning another type of program for you that he'll tell you about in the future.
Well, you want to give him a little tease, Professor?
Well, we did one program on global warming, and that it's a subject that has interested me for a long, long time. I think I'm pretty proficient at it. I understand it better than most, and it's will give you a different look at it. You hear two sides of that story. Well, there's actually a third side, and that's what we'll be talking about.
Everybody, get ready. I'll keep you posted, everybody, let you know when that's coming. If you're not a follower of the show, all you have to do is just click follow, and then you'll be notified of the date, the time, the guest, and the topic. So, again, look forward to that because, again, it's been in the news a lot lately, global warming. Every time you turn around, you're hearing that it's always in the news now. Somebody talking about global warming, If you really want to get a deep understanding about global warming and or climate change, then definitely you don't want to miss that show, and I'll let you know when that's going to be. Professor, great, great show as always. Again, thank you so much. We're very, very fortunate to have you as my guest. Thank you.
Thank you much. See you next week or 2 weeks.
All right.
Bye.
Talk to you soon. Everybody, that is Professor Joseph T. Geiger, author of the awesome book Entrepreneurial Success, 105 Business Principles, The Road to the Top. He's also written another book titled Finding a Career for Life. Finding a Career for Life. Great book. He delves into a lot of the different occupations out here and what they pay and what the average starting salary is, even if you decide to go to college, what a bachelor's degree in that chosen field will get you, what a master's degree, what a doctor's degree will get you in that field, so that you can make some educated decisions in terms of, you know, what you want to pursue in terms of your life as far as business is concerned or employment is concerned, because that's going to determine a lot in your life. I mean, what you do for a living in many cases is going to determine how much money you get paid for that said job. How much you get paid can determine where you live, right? It can determine the quality of your life. So it could determine what kind of car you drive, right? It can determine a lot, right? So you can also get that book at theroadtothetop.com, okay? So make sure you go over there. Great book for young people who are deciding on, you know, they're graduating and determining whether they want to go to college. Everybody doesn't go to college. You know, and some people do. But if you do go to college, you want to make sure that the major that you choose is something that's going to pay off in the future, especially if you're going to be having student loans to pay back. Okay? So, everybody, again, thank you for your time. I do appreciate you. As I always say, you could be doing something else, but you've taken time out of your day to spend it with my person and Professor Joseph T. Geiger. Remember, get the book if you're serious. Entrepreneurial Success, 105 Business Principles, The Road to the Top. All right, everybody, again, until the next time, my name is Juwanza. Who am I? I'm the one who, in giving, receives more. Who are you?